You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Allison Galen.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, book one by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, book two in the series. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in the chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Allison Galen on the show with me. She has a phenomenal new book called Never Look Back. And guys, this is one of the best suspense books of this year. You will not regret having this book on your bookshelf, and your bookshelf needs this book. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for the nice words.
Oh, you're so welcome. Before we get into talking about all that good stuff, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I think my first early memories would be when I was a kid, really young kid. I was an only child, so I didn't have a lot of places I could vent if I was, you know, maybe upset about something or, you know, didn't get the toy I wanted or whatever. And so I started just keeping little journals and writing to kind of get my anger out really early on. And then I started just thinking it was fun to write stories when I was little. I think when I was in fourth grade, I wrote a story about the baseball that Hank Aaron hit to beat Babe Ruth's record. And I wrote it from the baseball's point of view. And
I love that.
And I just liked the reaction I got from people, whether it was my parents or my friends or my teachers, when they would read these stories. So it was really pretty early on that I thought, boy, here's one thing that I really enjoy.
I love hearing those stories about when a young person is beginning to realize the storytelling gift and the encouragement that they get from teachers or parents or you know, anyone of influence in their life. How important, as a writer now, are those early memories and experiences that you had when someone realized that this might be something you're good at?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, by the same token, parents and teachers have the power to do the opposite as well.
Yes.
So, my parents were always really encouraging and most of my teachers. But then when I was in high school, I had this English teacher and I had really thought for sure, oh, I'm going to be a writer. That's what I'm going to do. And then I think I must have been a sophomore in high school and I got a B in the class and I'd always gotten A's in English. I wasn't the greatest math student, but English was like my class. And I asked her why I got a B, and she said, oh, I only give A's to people who will one day write professionally. That's what she told
me.
So, yeah, so I honestly got so discouraged by that I was like, okay, then. And I, you know, went to college and I studied theater because, of course, acting is so much more practical than writing. But I wasn't as good at it as I was at writing. So I found my way back to it, but it really did just, you know, it was like a kick in the stomach that lasted for years. So I don't think teachers realize how much power they can have to either encourage or discourage a kid especially as far as doing something creative goes.
Right. It's so powerful. And those, that one sentence can have impact for negative or in a positive direction. And so what did you went and studied theater?
Yes.
I've met lots of novelists who were frustrated theater people. You know, I don't know if it's because as a novelist you get to be director, actor, screen, or, you know, playwright and the whole nine yards. What was it that brought you from theater back to writing?
Well, that's really true. I often feel like writing is a lot like maybe directing or getting into a character. It's very similar to sort of the process of acting. But it was funny because I went to Northwestern. I studied theater there, and my acting teacher was always complimenting my writing journals and, you know, my acting journals, because we had to keep journals for class about the different characters, and telling me what a good writer I was. So as an actor, I was a really good writer. And so then I started taking, you know, creative writing classes in college, and then I got into the playwriting program at Northwestern, which was, you know, part of the theater major. But I took this playwriting course with this wonderful professor, Linda Jenkins. And so by the time I graduated, I knew, you know, this is it. It's still what I love. It's still what I need to do. I still need to write. So I think that's, you know, what it was. I always enjoyed acting, but I don't think I ever had a real passion for it, whereas writing has always been a passion. So, but I do think it's true that when I am writing a book, I mean, part of, especially if you're writing, I think psychological suspense, which is what I write, and you want your readers to really feel for the characters and kind of, so when you write it, you have to really get under their skin and so that the reader can have an almost visceral experience. And that's sort of the same thing as when you're trying to bring a character to life as either an actor or a director or a playwright. So I think it's very similar in that way.
You mentioned that you write psychological suspense, and do you remember what it was that that turned you on to that genre? Do you remember a book or an author or someone that opened your eyes that these kinds of stories could be told?
Sure. I mean, I think the very first psychological suspense I ever read was Edgar Allan Poe. You know, when I was a kid, my dad kind of introduced me to those books, and I always loved being scared. And to me, the biggest type of fear is sort of, you know, getting under the skin of a person who's experiencing some doubt or whatever, you know, psychologically. So from there, you know, another great early, you know, psychological suspense I read, and probably the first modern one, is Where Are the Children by Mary Higgins Clark, which is kind of the forerunner of a lot of the domestic and psychological suspense books today that came out in the 70s. Patricia Highsmith is another one, you know, early one that I love. Strangers on the Ripley books are great, but Strangers on the Train is one of my favorite books. Just the ability to get under the skin of this very complicated relationship between these men was so wonderful, I thought. So, yeah, I think it's always been the type of crime fiction that I've gravitated towards.
Sometimes I think that genre distinctions can be very confusing for a lot of people, and especially people that are not in, you know, quote unquote, the book industry. And you start breaking down genres, and it can be very, it can muddy the waters pretty quickly. What is it to you that separates psychological suspense from what we might think of as a garden variety mystery or, you know, a typical crime novel? There seems to be these little things that draw these distinctions, and how would you help someone navigate those waters?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I think it's mainly like the way these genres come into play the most are for the booksellers so they can figure out what shelf things on.
Yeah. Or Amazon for what page to put
everybody
it
else
on.
Will just put them all in the mystery section.
But
it's interesting. I mean, when I was really happy to sort of discover the genre of psychological suspense or you know, and I think it became talked about a lot more when, you know, books like Gone Girl came out. Because when I first had my first book published, it was 2005. And then if you were a woman writer, it seemed like they either wanted to pigeonhole you into writing into cozies, which is, you know, I guess you would say a bit of a lighter hearted type of crime fiction with some humor in it, character driven. There is the murder isn't taken quite as seriously and usually happens kind of off camera.
Right.
Or back then, romantic suspense was really big. And so that's sort of what I got pegged as writing, even though I don't write it. And I think the readers were, you know, didn't love my books because they really didn't have a lot of sex in them.
And there was no crazy ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, right.
Or boyfriend, for that matter.
Right. And there's no, like, giant love story at the core, which the best romantic suspense is, you know. You're as focused on the romantic aspect of it as you are of the, you know, usually woman in jeopardy and the crime. So I guess if you're navigating all of the, you know, the modern, the new genres, psychological suspense, domestic suspense, they say psychological thriller, you know, what's it called? Traditional mystery, et cetera. I think they say that traditional mysteries are more, kind of trying to figure out the puzzle of the plot, and you know, usually there's a procedural element to them with either a detective or, you know, a private eye or something like that. Then psychological suspense, a lot of times they tend, I don't want to generalize too much, but they tend to be female driven books. They tend to have the danger take place. I heard this description, which really helped. The danger comes from within the home rather than outside the home. So if you're dealing with, you know, a mystery where, like, you know, there's a serial killer after you and he's out there, or there's, you know, some horrible thing, don't go outside your house, or, you know, that's one thing. In a psychological or domestic suspense, the danger's within the home. So your child isn't who you think they are, or they may be in danger, or your husband isn't who you think he is. He has secrets that's going to put your whole family into danger. Stuff like that. I think that might be the best way to differentiate it from other types of genres. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. You first published in 2005. What was the idea for that book that led you to writing the book, and did you know that this was going to be the story that that helped you start your publishing career?
Well, no, actually, the first book I published was called Hide Your Eyes, and it was started out as a short story. And, you know, I was working in magazines in New York, and I was taking a fiction writing workshop. So I wrote this short story. There was a story in the news that really captivated me. And it went on to become called the Baby Hope case. And there was a little child's body that was discovered in an ice chest in the Hudson River. And somebody claimed to have seen a couple putting the ice chest in the river. And the police who were involved in the case got very emotionally involved with it because, you know, obviously there's this little girl, I think she was like 3 or 4 years old, and they really were very emotionally invested in trying to solve this case. And it was a big kind of story in the New York newspapers at the time, you know, back in the 90s. So that interested me. So I thought to myself, what if there was a person who saw, what about that person who saw that couple dropping the ice chest into the river, and what if they saw them? So that was sort of the basis of this short story I wrote. And I was in a workshop with this wonderful writer and teacher named Abigail Thomas. She went on to become a pretty well-known memoirist who wrote A Three Dog Life and other books. And she told me, oh, you should turn this into a mystery novel. And I was like, well, how do I do that? Because, you know, I like to read all types of books, but I never really had thought of writing one. I just thought I liked to write short stories and things. So I just started making this short story longer and longer and longer and longer until I had, you know, the right amount of pages to make it into a novel. And I submitted it to my husband's cousin worked for an agent. And so I gave it to her, and the agent allowed her to send it around. I got some really, really wonderful rejection letters. So then I realized, after maybe the third or fourth or fifth or sixth rejection letter that said they really liked the characters and, you know, the dialogue, but the plot really wasn't compelling, that I needed to go read a lot of mysteries, and I need to go back to page one and completely rewrite this book. So that's what I did. I read easily sort of like 100 mysteries within a year, everything from, you know, Crime and Punishment to Faye Kellerman books to Patricia Cornwell, everything I could find, you know, modern stuff, classic stuff. And I started to realize the importance of creating a good structure and a good plot. So then I went back to page one and I did a complete rewrite of the book. And it took me, like, I think the first draft of the book had taken me 5 years. This took me another 5 years. I mean, I was obviously doing other stuff at the time. I wasn't just sitting there writing a book, but that would be really crazy making. But it took me 5 years, and I rewrote it. And then I found an agent of my own who wasn't related to anybody in my family, and Deborah Schneider, who's my agent today. And she liked it and sent it out, and I got a contract with NAL, which is no longer really around, but it was a division of Penguin. And it became a book called Hide Your Eyes. And it was about a box office worker in an off Broadway theater who sees these people dropping an ice chest in the river. And she's surrounded by all these kind of crazy wannabe actors. And so there's a lot of sort of humor in it, but the crime itself is really horrifying and it connects with a serial killer thing. It was, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, but it wound up getting published and weirdly enough nominated for an Edgar. So that was my first book. I write different books now. I have a lot of affection for that book because it was my first, but it was sort of a case of, wow, that was an interesting idea. Oh, and then they said, oh, is this a series? Because back then, you know, series books were really huge. And I'm like, of course it's a series. So it's like, how many books can you write about an off Broadway box office worker and, you know, like spots crimes happening? So I wrote one more. Then I started writing some standalones, and then I moved over to HarperCollins, where I did a series about an actual private eye. So that was a little easier. I did like three books of that, then went back to standalones again.
Nice. Well, speaking of Edgar Awards, you won the Edgar just a few months ago, didn't you, for If I Die Tonight?
Yes, I did. It was
congratulations.
Thrilling. Thank you. Thank you. It was a big surprise. It was my fourth nomination, and I'd gotten really good at smiling and being clapping graciously, and that was sort of what I figured I'd be doing again. So when it happened, it was a real thrill and so gratifying and so nice after all these years that the mystery writing community is such a supportive and wonderful community, and to win that award surrounded by so many friends and in such great company as far as the other nominees went, it was pretty wonderful. I actually think our category, it was paperback original, was the first time that category had ever been all women before. So,
wow.
Yeah, kind of says how far we've come in just a short amount of time.
Well, that and how broad your audience has to be. Mm-hmm. It's most of my favorite books of the past year have been women suspense and thriller writers. Like there's such a strong stable of writers right now putting out amazing books.
Absolutely, yeah. And I've talked to a lot of people, women and men, who feel the same way. I mean, it's, you want to say it's our time, but it should just be like all the time.
It should. And you know, I long for the day where we don't notice things like that. You know, oh, this was written by a woman. Well, who cares? It's a fantastic book.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I feel the same way.
Yeah. Well, I love the story that you told me a few minutes ago about the advice that you got to go read some mysteries and to work on your plotting, because your books are some of the most amazingly plotted books, you have a real knack for taking timely topics. And we're going to talk about your newest book in just a minute and how that what I'm alluding to there. Mm-hmm. Taking timely topics and things that are of interest to people right now, without seeming like you're using it as a plot device on purpose. And that was so clunkily said, but, I think you, like your newest book, Never Look Back, there's it's centered around a podcast, and I love that because we're talking on a podcast right now.
Yes, podcasts are great.
But, you know, true crime podcasts are like all the rage right now, and you expertly use that in this book, and it doesn't seem like a gimmick because that's popular right now. In your study and learning, you know, all that you did about plot, what were some things that jumped out at you and that you were mindful of to be able to say, okay, this is what I did wrong previously, and this is how I'm going to correct that? Were there some kind of glaring things that jumped out at you?
Yes. You know, the first, one thing I would really advise people, especially if they're in writing groups, is to not take every single person's advice, particularly when they say, this isn't clear enough. The first draft was too clear. It was like everything was telegraphed, you know, and it was just too just sort of like this happens and this happens and this happens. It's okay to have a reader be thrown off balance and be a little bit confused as long as you know where you're going and what direction you're going in. And stories can be told any number of ways. I mean, you have like this wonderful toolbox. You can tell everything from one point of view in the first person. That's one type of way to keep things mysterious. Or you can switch points of view, and then you realize that one character wasn't seeing things correctly at all, and they were the character that you believed and trusted. So you've got all these things at your disposal. And also, one of the, you know, the main things I learned too is to be able to read my own books the way I read these other mysteries. So in other words, to just sort of, you know, finish my first draft, put it aside for a week or two, and then go back over it with a fresh eye and be merciless. Like, you are telling a story, and no matter how beautiful a passage is or how much you might love a little certain ancillary character, if they're not feeding into your story and they're not helping you tell that story, then they've got to go. You got to kill those darlings. You know, you've got to just be merciless in your rewrite, or else a lot of things aren't going to work. The pacing isn't going to work. The story that you're trying to tell is not going to be told in the most effective way. So, you know, I think not just the mysteries themselves, but the act of reading all those mysteries helped me to be more objective about my own work and less sort of married to it. So I think that it's just, that was invaluable.
You said that it's okay to have readers confused and thrown off balance, and especially if they want to keep turning pages.
Yes.
You can pull readers along down all sorts of rabbit trails as long as they keep wanting to know what happens. How do you mix reader engagement with playing tricks on us?
Well, that's the most important thing, is developing characters that people are compelled by. And I don't necessarily mean likable characters. I don't really even know what that means, because you're going to like or not like a character just like you're going to not like a person. But they have to be real and compelling and believable and interesting. And to me, the only character that I find unlikable is somebody who's flawless. Like, I hate that character. I have plenty of flaws, and my friends do, and that's what makes us human, you know? So, and by the same token, I mean, I don't tend to write villains at all anyway. I write, you know, people who do the wrong thing, but, you know, maybe I wouldn't call them villains. But even if you're writing like a classic villain, to give them, you know, a grain of nobility or something, they have to believe in what they're doing. Most villains don't run around going, I'm a bad guy, I'm evil. You know, they think they're doing the right thing. They're the hero. Everybody's the hero of their own story. So I think the key to get people turning the pages is to keep the character, to focus on character, to make them compelling, to make them believable, to make them mysterious in a way, but to make them somebody that your reader wants to go along for the ride with, you know? So creating the right character, the right narrative voice is really, really important in terms of getting your readers involved.
Let's come back to the new book for a minute, Never Look Back. This book is, it's such an amazing book, and it has a very complicated narrative that it seems complicated in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And you're dealing with multiple timelines. The book deals with a mass murder, mm-hmm. or a series of mass murders. And I believe that this is informed by something real that happened. Is that true?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Tell us where first off, when you're working on a new story and it's still in the idea phases, when you're kind of asking what ifs and you know, wondering if there's a story here, what usually comes to you first? Is it a character? Is it a setting? Is it like a news story? Is it just a series of what if questions? How does the germ of the idea of the book start coming to you?
Whenever, a lot of times it does, it is either a news story or maybe a story that somebody else tells me of a true thing that happened. If I Die Tonight, my previous book, the germ of that was a story that my daughter told me that was a local news story that happened. What always makes me get those ideas and say, I want to spend 300 pages on it, is if I hear either a news story or something that happened, and I think, what if that were me? Or what if that were me in that situation? And when I start thinking that, I feel like that's when I know I'm on to something. So the murder spree that takes place in Never Look Back is, it's a different murder spree, but it's based on the Charles Starkweather murders of the 1950s. And that's always fascinated me. There's a movie, Badlands, by Terrence Malick, that's based on those murders. And that's one of my favorite movies. There's a Bruce Springsteen song called Nebraska based on the murders. And I think Natural Born Killers was also, there's tons of people. There's a Lawrence Block book that's based on them. There's tons of people that have been inspired by these murders because the killers were so young and they were a couple. And the story is that 19-year-old Charles Starkweather took his 14-year-old girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate, and they killed like a dozen people or something in Nebraska in the 1950s. If you look at the story, though, and the thing that made me think, what if that were me or what if that were my mother, is that if you look at it, it's very clear that Carolyn Fugate was a kidnapping victim. She wasn't this wasn't some kind of crazy Romeo and Juliet, Bonnie and Clyde thing happening. It was she had broken up with him. He killed her family when she got home from school. He lied to her and told her that her sister was her little sister was still alive, or her mother and little sister were still alive. And that if she did what he said, that, you know, the people who were keeping them would keep them safe. So she goes with him on this murder spree, and he's killing all these people and all these horrible things are happening. And she's terrified and she's too scared to ask for help. She's a 14-year-old kid. And then finally the police get them, and instead of, she thinks she's being rescued, but then she's arrested, tried and convicted based on his testimony of being an accessory to murder, and she's sentenced to life in prison. So she was let out eventually on good behavior, and I think anybody, if this case happened today, people would say, oh, this is a kidnapping victim. But I really wanted to write it from that perspective, because everything, all these things that I actually love, I love that Springsteen song, I love Badlands, Lawrence Block is an amazing writer, all of it came from the point of view, which was the general feeling at the time, which was that, you know, this was a couple, this was a murderous couple. So I decided to kind of take that. Now, when I was writing it, I wrote this series of letters from the young girl to her future daughter, which starts out as a school assignment. And then when her boyfriend takes her on this thing, it just becomes kind of a journal. She is not, as I wrote it, I realized I couldn't make her as much of a victim as I perceive Caroline Fugate to have been, because I think that would just be too depressing. So she's a little bit more of a survivor, and she's a little bit more changed by the crimes that she's taken on, and she becomes tougher and discovers dark parts of her own psyche that kind of enables her to survive. So that's where it differs from it. And also it takes place in the 70s rather than the 50s, so I could have it go to current day. But that was what originally inspired me.
Well, and the current day story, we've got a podcaster, like we talked about. How did you decide to tell the present day story you've got the historical situation that you want to play off of and kind of turn on its head a little bit. How do we bring that into the present?
Well, so I wanted to create this character whose life was destroyed by the murders, and that is the podcaster, whose name is Quentin Garrison. And he's a young man. He wasn't even born in 1976 when the murders occurred. But his mother's younger sister, 4-year-old sister, was one of the people killed by this couple. They were presumed to have died in a fire. So he decides that he's going to make a podcast called Closure. It's really more the suggestion of his best friend and his husband that he do this podcast. And where he interviews people that were involved, you know, victims of this crime, one of whom was his grandfather, who he's been estranged from. But in the course of this, he's contacted by a source who says that April Cooper, the young girl, is actually still alive. She's a mother. She lives in New York State. And she has a daughter who's grown up and is a columnist out in New York. So he contacts her, and it sets in course this just horrible turn of events. But I decided to make him a podcaster rather than a straight up journalist, because I didn't want somebody who was just objective about a crime. I wanted somebody creating a personal type of thing. And I'm a huge true crime podcast fan. And the thing that I love about them so much is they feel to me like stories told around a campfire more than, you know, just reading an article. I feel like all the hosts of these podcasts have an emotional stake in the true crime story, which makes it that much more fascinating. Whether it's, you know, there's a Happy Face Killer podcast where the woman who is the host of it discovered that her father was Jesperson, who was the Happy Face murderer, serial killer. So that's very personal, right? But then there's also, you know, if you look at Serial, Sarah Koenig went into that with a very specific goal, which was to prove this guy innocent of a crime he was in prison for. She wasn't trying to be an objective journalist. She was setting about to do something. Or if you look at a podcast like S-Town, which is probably my favorite, the host, Brian Reed, you know, starts out very objective, but gets so emotionally involved with the main character that it's just very moving, you know? So I like that. I like the podcast host as the, you know, subjective, unreliable narrator. So no offense to podcast hosts. You know what I mean? Like, I love it, and I just love the form.
It's more like documentary making than, the NBC Nightly News or you know, the host has an agenda. We all have seen documentaries, and they all have an agenda. Not that that's good or bad, but it's just the way it is. You know, you're telling a story from a perspective, and I think that's the difference. And is that we're definitely getting someone's personal perspective.
Yeah, I think podcast hosts are maybe like journalists meet novelists in a way.
Yeah, you know? I like that.
Yeah.
When you first started working on that aspect of it, we know that when a book comes to market, it's been in the works for probably 2 years at that point. Did you realize that it was going to be as popular as true crime podcasts are right now?
No, I didn't. I think it was like I started writing it, you know, right around, yeah, I think, well, Serial had already happened, you know, so I thought, oh, that's great. And then I think, you know, maybe a couple of them, but I didn't know whether the popularity of them was going to continue or anything at all. And it's interesting because there were a few other crime fiction books that have come out that involve podcasts since then. And it's like, I wasn't trying to hop on a trend. I honestly think all of us had the same idea at the
exactly.
same time, which happens all the time.
It does. Yeah. Do you ever weigh the risks of using something that might be, you know, kind of a pop culture thing at the moment? What are the, what's the decision making when you're weighing, do I do this or not? Will, you know, 2 years down the road when this comes to market, will that be a thing? And, you know, is that, if it's not, will that sink a book? You know, does that ever come into play in your planning?
It doesn't. Maybe it should more, but it doesn't.
No, I like that it doesn't.
Like, yeah, because I've, you know, my previous book, If I Die Tonight, was like, there's so much social media in it and, you know, and everything. You know, when I was talking about teenagers and social media, and teenagers, you know, change from year to year. You know, the teenagers of 2016 are very different from the teenagers now, and the use of social media is really different. I think it's impossible to write a book, particularly a timely crime fiction book, without it feeling dated at some point. So my feeling is just go for it. You know, I'm writing about the time that I'm in when I'm writing it. I'm chronicling this moment in time, you know, and so at some point my books are going to feel historical to people, and that's fine to me. You know, I've taken writing classes in the past, and they're like, oh, don't include songs of the times or whatever, because that dates your book. Well, guess what? The very way you phrase something, or the way you look at the world, or the relationship between men and women in your book, or the freedom that a kid might have in your book is going to date your book anyway. So I say go for it. Like, you know, show your time period for all you can. I mean, we're chroniclers of our time as well as storytellers.
That's right. Your books have so many twists and turns, and you keep us guessing and turning pages the whole time. How much planning, or what does the planning portion of your book writing look like?
Well, basically what I do, my very first books, which are a lot less complicated than my books now, I did try to do a detailed outline, but I always end up going off the outline. So I'm not an outliner. I'm not exactly what they call a pantser either, because I sort of know where I want everything to come out. But it's sort of the getting there that I kind of liken it to feeling my way around a dark room and finding the light switch. So I write a lot of scenes that don't work, and then I go back and I rewrite them. I outline a little bit, but just maybe three chapters ahead of where I am, just so I have like some kind of roadmap for where I'm going. And then I eventually know where I want to end up. When I'm writing books like Never Look Back, or If I Die Tonight, or also What Remains of Me, which is my previous book, those are all sort of multiple narrator books. What Remains of Me and this book are two different time periods. I do timelines for each character. So that way I can sort of get straight when this character was doing this, that character was doing this. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's like I draw little timelines, and I just keep them on a notepad in front of me as I'm writing, so I can just sort of, and I still make mistakes and copy editors still get irritated with me, but that's kind of how I do it. But I feel like the big key to writing a complicated but still followable book is rewriting. You know, my first draft is almost like, you know, I change so much between the first and second draft. It's not even funny. My first drafts are usually just horrible, make very little sense, and they're awful. So I do a lot of rewriting, rearranging. Never Look Back, I probably did the most structural changing in my rewrite of any book I've ever written. But, you know, I feel like don't be afraid to change things. Don't be afraid to stand back, look at it, and just, you know, switch scenes around.
Well, a first draft might be horrible, but at least it's there, and it's then editable and malleable and can be shaped into the thing that it will ultimately be.
Yes, definitely.
Well, the new book is called Never Look Back. Allison, this is definitely one of my favorite books of the year. I've been telling everybody about it.
I'm so happy. That's great. Yeah,
we're going to put links to it in the show notes to this episode. If people are just learning about you and want to, you know, dig into more of what you do and get in your back catalog and all that good stuff, is there a place where they can find you online?
Sure. I'm on Twitter, just Allison Galen. I have a Facebook page as well. I'm on Instagram, and then I've got a website, AllisonGalen.com.
Excellent. Are you presently working on another book?
I am, yes. And it is first person present tense, one narrator, at least for now. Ooh. So we'll see how that works.
Oh, that's going to be fascinating. Allison, I've loved getting to chat with you and getting to know you. We're going to send everyone to see you and to pick up their copy of the new book. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you so much. This was such a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning into the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
I was walking through the woods between Wolfert's Roost and the future site of my father's Stone Manor house. The house would eventually stand on what had been old Baltus's pumpkin field, the land where I had found my grandfather's head. Father had chosen the spot for its view of the Hudson River. Knoll was to be a grand mansion in the Gothic Revival style, but at the time the mansion was but a few foundations of Van Brunt stone. I had become fond of the place already, the idea of it, and I spent many a night alone in a shack on the property. My mother disapproved. She would have me sleep in the room across from hers in our townhouse. But I was 15 and did not answer to her. I kept a bottle of spirits hidden in the crook of two walnut trees near old Baltus's grave. I thought he would approve of the gesture. I had stopped along my way to fetch it out. At the moment the first pull of liquor touched my throat, I heard a ghastly, inhuman laugh. I was not alone in the woods. Had God sent the horseman after me? Had I sinned that terribly? I ran through the wood and found the field where Knoll was to be built. The outline of the foundations was barely discernible beneath the snow. An apparition stood there. Though I have seen him many times since, I shall never forget my first glimpse. Gaunt in moonlight, headless, exuding power and malice. A magic thing in the land of the ordinary. The headless horseman of Sleepy Hollow. What chills those words evoke. It charged at me, hatchet raised. I stood transfixed, unable to move, unable to even imagine escape. This was the servant of God, after all, sent to strike down sinners. I hurled the bottle from my hand, ashamed that I had become a drunkard as Baltus had been. It shattered against the foundations of Knoll. I stretched out my arms and awaited judgment. A piercing white light broke the darkness. The horse reared.
"Not my Dillon!" cried Agatha,
appearing from the wood. She held a skull in her hand. It shone brightly as a diamond. And in that moment I understood. The horseman did not serve God. He served my grandmother. Perhaps in that moment I came to see Agatha and God as one and the same. The unholy spirit fought her command. A foreleg of the demon horse struck my head with such power that I fell backwards with a cry and knew no more. I carry the scar to this day. A slight indentation in my temple, barely noticeable. In my days of courting, I was told that when I am angry, the patch of insulted skull bone will stand out in a disturbing manner. I have never had occasion to see this phenomenon, however, as I am generally well pleased whenever I pass a mirror.